Exhibition number 23213, Rule 14.
Major Potts, Rule 14. What were the particular skills you learned when you were being taught beer tracker?
Very difficult to say, but the thing is, you've got to learn really to see where people have moved before you. And this is by small twigs broken on trees, footprints, how long ago the footprints were made, had there been rain since the footprints were made, cigarettes, if there were cigarette ends, how long ago, how long had they been there? If it had been for 2 days, they would have started, the tobacco would have started to come out, the gum would have come undone. Were they locally made cigarettes? Or were they rolled cigarettes? Tins? Animals? What animals are there in the neighbourhood? Fires? How long ago was a fire used? Had there been rain since, or heavy dew? Not so much heavy dew, but sometimes in drier parts of the world, you get a fire and it will keep warm for 36 hours if it's been properly used and cooked on. So one learnt about sanitation. You learnt that you didn't wash for a simple reason. They can smell your soap, or a terrorist can smell your soap up to a mile away. I think one of the biggest problems with the British troops is they've always got to stop for the cup of tea, and they've always got to have a brew up. And you start at 9 in the morning, at 12 it's brew time and eats, and you've got to make camp at night. That's no good. If you're going to be a proper tracker and take people out to really get at the enemy, you've got to go out and try and live as near to the people you are tracking or like the people you are tracking. Frank Kitson is a typical example of this. You may have interviewed him or not, but he did gangs and counter-gangs in Kenya, and he was very successful with a chap called Ray Nightingale, who is long departed.
When you sent your patrols out, what strength were they normally?
Kaya, Mama, some of them were, if they were in not too far in the jungle, some of them never more than about 6 or 7. You can't fire, you can't bring up any firepower more than the first 2 or 3, same as Malaya. Although the forests of East Africa, there is no undergrowth like there is in Malaya.
Were you patrolling every day? Would you have patrols out every single day?
Yes, pretty well, yeah. But you see, when you take a company, you've got to have escorts for vehicles. You've got patrols. You've got routine. And, of course, we were, in some respects, Mama, we had to have 1 day a week, which was sort of an admin day for the African, or the majority of the Africans. You can't keep people on at the top if you keep them on all the time. So, therefore, I'd say the average person would do 3 to 4 days a week patrolling, and the rest of the time in camp. But again, you've got to, if you're in camp, you've got to do your guards.
So how many, you know, roughly what sort of patrol effort were you making? How many patrols would you have out at a time?
Well, if we were on, especially around squares, we would have ambushes out. Quite a lot of ambushes. We would also have a couple of follow-up patrols ready in case any animals have been hijacked in our area, and as soon as we heard that they had been We generally didn't hear early enough the following morning. Often, if we could have heard about it at about first light or soon after first light, we could have done something about it. But generally, they got into the forest before we knew about it.
Roughly how many farms were there in your area?
A difficult question, I suppose. A couple of dozen, maybe a few more. Remembering that the average Mau Mau would run a herd of, or a flock of sheep, 10 or 15 miles in a night, and get them into the forest by first light. So you got a pretty good idea of where they were going, but we didn't always catch them. And often they had to, you know, they dispersed as soon as they realised we were after them.
You were saying that air intelligence or air photo recce wasn't really much good. What other sources of intelligence were there available to you?
To be honest, I thought the intelligence I have experienced in Malaya, Kenya, and in Korea was terrible. Always has been. And I believe that the same is going on in Afghanistan at the moment. The we would get reports that General so-and-so or General so-and-so, who was generally a farm labourer, self-promoted, was going to do something. You could guarantee it never happened. We were told from time to time there was going to be a big meeting on the southern side of the Kinnan Kop, or the northern side of the Kinnan Kop, and there would be a meeting of 200 Mau Mau, and you'd go up to the land on top, look round, nothing there. It was, a lot of it was rumour and counter-rumour, and it's like all these things, if you only listen to the people in the headquarters or around the headquarters, you do not get the nitty-gritty. We tried with getting people, interrogating people on the farms. Generally, the farmers themselves, so why farmers could give you more information than any. We didn't have very many in the White area, the White Highland area, if you like, spies or informers. It was, they just didn't want to, because they knew if they were caught, they'd be disemboweled.
Were your own soldiers able to get anything out of the local population?
Not really. You see, a thing which is not often realised today, basically, Mau Mau was one tribe. It was Kikuyu, who, in fact, are the most intelligent Africans, living on the eastern side of the Aberdares, and were the most industrious Africans. And we go back to tracking slightly. Brilliant trackers on the plain were the Maasai. Put them in the forest, they hadn't a clue what to do. They weren't very good at discipline. The best people were the Wakamba, and we had quite a lot of Nandi, Kipsigis, and people from the Northern Frontier District.
Did the Mau Mau make any attempt to subvert the loyalty of your troops that you were aware of?
Not that I'm aware of, and I don't think they did, because the average Askari came from, as I said, certain tribes, and they despised the Kikuyu like nobody's business. You know, every time they shot one, it was the greatest thing that had ever happened. Awful thing to say in this day of political correctness, but it is true.
If you weren't getting good intelligence, how then were you able to choose your ambush sites?
Well, you would say, right, they've a certain area of the White Highlands below our camp, seems to be quite a lot of stuff stolen, and we have our intelligence. The intelligence was our intelligence, our own intelligence in the company,
locally
generated, that they were running up into the forest between point A and point B.
Would that be by deduction?
Well, by deduction. And we were never very far wrong. We actually, it was knowing when they'd gone into the forest. It was getting people to the places. You see, 12 miles for a company is a lot of distance.
Thinly spread.
Yeah, very thinly spread. And I'm afraid to say we weren't as good as we should have been. But for what reason, I still don't know. I think we did do it as I would still do it the way we did it. Because I think we did get the results, and Mau Mau, although it went on for a few years, it became weaker and weaker because we had more and more success.
How deep into the forest would your patrols go?
Well, it goes straight up onto the moorland above. I mean, you could go, actually, there were tracks, odd tracks, where you could take vehicles right up onto the top of the moorland. Although the moorland was very cold at night. Bitterly cold frost, and there were several tracks where you could drive right across the Aberdares down into the European farming area on the far side, around going from Nakuru to Naivasha and down to Nairobi that way.
Did you do vehicle patrols as well as foot patrols?
Well, not really. Mau Mau didn't have any vehicles. They would have heard a vehicle 2 miles away, and they would have just sat 10 yards off the road, and that was it.
You mentioned the Special Branch came up and made all sorts of accusations after you'd shot the Mau Mau you found in the gorge. What were your relations like with the police and Special Branch generally, day to day?
We have very, very good relations with the police. We found the police, well, the police were mostly ex-army anyway. I'm talking about the European assistant superintendents and superintendents. And they were first class. The Askaris, well, they were okay. Yeah, they were more military police than anything else, military than policemen in a lot of respects. No, we had good relations. Special Branch, we only saw them when they thought they could get you. I didn't have very much time for a Special Branch because they never did anything. I mean, they were... Well, I just didn't have much time for them.
Did they not produce anything of value?
Not really, no. Not as far as I was concerned. And I don't know what other people had. I can't speak for others.
You mentioned that the farmers were encouraged to protect their own farmhouses.
Yeah.
What sort of measures could they take?
Well, they could put barbed wire up, allow no African into the farmhouse area during the night, have arc lights. And that was about it. You know, and dogs, but not sort of Rockefellers in those days. Generally, some yapping little dog.
Were the farmers armed?
Yes, they were. Yeah, they all wore pistols, and they were always losing them. Everybody carried a gun of some sort, European. I mean, the Mau Mau were not what I would call an aggressive enemy. They didn't do aggressive acts like try and ambush a convoy of, say, 3 vehicles, or even 1 vehicle.
I was going to say, were there any direct attacks initiated by them on your...
We never had any problems at all. I mean, there were 2 or 3 well-known and well-catalogued Mau Mau attacks, but nothing we had... I cannot think that we were ever shot at in our camp.
What about your camp? Was that defended? Did it
Oh, yeah. We were barbed wired in. We had, I think, on top of the dairy, we had a chat with a searchlight, and we had a couple of patrolling askaris going round the whole time. It was a grass area, so we were okay.
Were you dug in?
Oh no, there was no digging in, except the latrines.
You mentioned earlier on that during this time you were court martialed.
That's another story. I went down to Neary one night with my escort to the Outspan, a very well known hotel in Kenya, and I was meeting a chap I knew called Wynne Dauncey, who was the public prosecutor in Neary. And we went and had dinner in the Outspan Hotel, and after dinner we went to the bar. Now, it was quite a long colonial-type bar, and we were at one end, and there were a whole lot of Kenya regiment and Kenyans down the other end, and they started to shoot the odd bottle off the bar with their pistols. Well, this, I suppose there were half a dozen shots, when suddenly a man came up with in a civilian suit and said to me, I'm arresting you for discharging a firearm in public. And so I said to him, I'm awfully sorry, I have not got a firearm on me. I was actually wearing a jacket and a pair of trousers. And I said, there you are, you can have a look. He said, no, I'm being told that you fired a shot at the bottle. I said, I haven't got a gun on me. So, what you got? And he put his arm on my shoulder and he said, you're under arrest. And I said, look, I'm giving you 10 seconds. I'll count to 10. And if you don't take your hand off me, I will think that you are assaulting me. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. Bang, and down he went with a broken jaw. I then walked out with Wynne Dauncey and went back and had a couple of drinks in his hotel, and I went home. Anyway, 2 days later, Army Special Branch arrived, and this major arrived, and he said, I understand you had a fracas. I said, yes, I did. And you were firing, you fired your weapon. I said, I did not fire my weapon. I didn't have a weapon on me. And he said, I have to take a statement. I said, well, I'll give you a statement. And I have to take your weapon, because we've got to test it against the bullets that are behind the bar. And I said, yeah, you're welcome to have it. And away he went. Anyway, I suppose 2 or 3 weeks later, the pistol came back with a note to say, it wasn't your pistol. Well, I knew that. Anyway, and then about 2 months later, I got a note to say there will not be a summary of evidence, but there will be a whole lot of statements were. And due to the fact that I hadn't even seen my CO. I never saw my CO. I hadn't seen CO. Anyway, and I was given, the adjutant came out and he said, you ought to be court-martialed. The chief of staff says, as it's a military policing problem, you ought to be court-martialed. I said, well, that's all right, don't mind. So, anyway, I went to Nairobi. It meant 2 or 3 days in Nairobi. Great. I knew I was completely and utterly in the right, except breaking this chap's jaw. So, got to Nairobi, and the court-martial was to be at 2 o'clock. Anyway, I appeared properly dressed at 2 o'clock, and I got a statement from Wynne Dauncey to say that, as a public prosecutor, and they said, have you a defence counsel? No. How do you plead? And I said, not guilty. So And then they said, who's the prosecution witness? And their prosecution witness, the chap I had hit, does anybody know what he looks like? And I said, yes, I do. So the president of the court martial then said, court adjourned. And I was sent off in the president's car to find the bloody prosecution witness. So I went down to Nairobi. I knew where the police hung out in Nairobi. And there he was. And I said, you're wanted. Up at whatever name of the barracks was. So I took him back. And the court was reconvened. And, well, I proved my point. And then I said, okay, I plead guilty to hitting him under great provocation. So, court adjourned, I plead guilty. So they had to close the court and then it consider sentence. So, court was duly shut and open and found guilty to be reprimanded. So, nothing else, you see. And the court was then adjourned. I went out and the court was adjourned. The president sent for me then and said, don't lose your temper. I knew the brigadier because I played rugby. And he was the sort of head of the rugby in East Africa. And he said, don't lose your temper with people. And I said, well, I think I was pretty well provoked there. And you had the statement from the public prosecutor to say that I was provoked. I know, he said, but you did lose your temper, I can tell that. So I thought, well, what do I do now? Do I go back to my own regiment, who was still in Kenya, and say what I've done? You know, they'll all know. And I went back anyway, and I saw Peter Slane, who was he was second in command. And I said, Peter, I think I have to resign from the army. He said, don't be a fool. Everybody here thinks it's the funniest thing that's happened for years. And it's never been mentioned in the regiment again, ever. Of course, the troops, all the inner skillings had heard about it. And but, I mean, it should never have happened. It was a complete and utter fiasco. But it was done. Michael Carver was the chief of staff. And he was trying to make a point that the army and the police were in cahoots on everything. But I don't blame him. So that was the end of that story.
Until you never saw your own CO, who was your real
name? My CO was a chap in Kenya called Watson Gandhi. Yeah. He was a Black Watch. And battalion headquarters and one company were in Nanyuki on a wartime footing. And then he came up about once every 6 to 8 weeks to see the company. Mind you, it was 50 miles. And we were completely isolated. I suppose the nearest people we had was 70 East Africa Brigade. Used to go down there occasionally to see them. But it was an extraordinary life. I spent 18 months in the KAR. I don't think I went in the regimental mess more than 3 times. I certainly never went to a dinner night or to anything, any function. And one was an independent company commander.
How did you spend your time when you were an independent company commander? Were you out visiting your platoons or were you in your command post back at company commander?
I think I was out with my platoons visiting farmers by day and I don't honestly know. I can't remember that far back. Going out to dinner, being asked out to dinner quite a lot. Because I had a police wire set in my Land Rover to get through. Nobody... the whole time, when I left Kenya, I said to somebody at the time, the quartermaster had never visited me the whole time I was in the KAR. Extraordinary.
Did you run short of anything, or were you generally well supplied?
Well, I was told off once for telling the quartermaster on the open radio that I couldn't live on air forever if he didn't send any rations up. No, we were badly administered. Our radios were bad, and if it hadn't been for the police network, we'd have got through to nowhere. I think I don't know how much longer this tape's got. We then moved to Mwega.
What happened
when
you got there then?
Well, Mwega had an airstrip, about 800 metre airstrip. It was the headquarters of the Kenya Police Reserve Air Force, which was consisted of, I think, 6 or 8 Pacers, tri-Pacers, 2 Cessnas, and I'm not certain, 1 or 2 private aircraft belonging to KPR officers. The KPR, they were Kenya Police Reserve, they were ex-RAF, ex-farmers, and they did a wonderful job during the emergency, spying or trying to find intelligence. They also supplied battalions with packs thrown out, you know, free airdrops. I mean, they're only little aeroplanes with one man flying and one pushing the stuff out. And I suppose the total weight of the stuff they could push out was no more than the weight of 2 men. And they were done in 5-man packs. And they did it to Africans and they did it to European battalions. And they were run by a man who only had one arm. And he flew as well. A chap called Punch Bearcroft. I believe after independence, he became head of the whole Air Force, of that type, police Air Force. And Mwega was also a sort of administrative, if you like. It was on the edge of the native reserve. We weren't very far from Treetops Hotel. It was really... It was quite a nice place to be. We were about 8 miles from Nyeri, so we could go down to Nyeri odd nights. You had to be careful coming back because you find all the elephants standing on the road. And if you remember the early Land Rovers, their lights were not terribly good.
What was the ground like there? Was that open country?
No, it was mostly coffee. Coffee bushes, you know, like tea bushes.
Was there a level?
You're not recording, are you?
Yes.
Oh.
Was there a level of activity in that area?
Oh, there were lots, because the coffee estate and the tea, I think there was some tea there, certainly coffee, highly labour intensive. So therefore, I think the Mau Mau came into the estates bullied the labour force for food.
Sounds rather like what the communists were doing in Malaya in the early.
Well, that's right. And although we did not go around, we didn't interfere in the coffee estates. When we got down to Mwega, within a very short time, all the European battalions were withdrawn to Nairobi to the European battalions had moved down to Nairobi area, and they were going to carry out this big operation and screen all Africans in Nairobi, called Operation Anvil, which was a very big operation. And we were sent up into the forest to sweep the forest down from the top of the forest down to the edge of the forest and try and flush out what gangs there were. I think we were in the forest for 10 days, maybe longer.
What sort of operation was that, this sweep? Was it battalion?
No, this was, I think, on our side of the Aberdares, there were certainly 4 or 5 KR battalions. An impossible situation. But it was a very interesting one, from my point of view, because we came down through treetops, and coming down, we had masses of rhino, we had lots of Cape buffalo,